David Bianculli is the television critic and frequent guest host on NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and he's an associate professor of TV and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. His latest book, The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific, explores the transformation of a medium once described as a vast wasteland to the vibrant and complex art form available today. His book is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased it has brought David Bianculli to our show. Welcome.
I am so happy to be here.
Was there ever a golden age of TV?
Oh, I think so. I mean, they pegged the golden age as when you did live TV drama and you had writers like Patty Chayefsky and Reginald Rose and Rod Serling. Yeah, that's a golden age. And they did it very early when nobody had defined the medium yet.
Were they trying to fill time? For example, I remember seeing The Iceman Cometh with Jason Robards on Channel 13 before it was a PBS station.
Yes.
In fact, they did a whole bunch of theater, great theater, on that station.
Yeah, part of the early anthology dramas, the live ones, was a mixture of getting young writers who they could process things through very cheaply and doing adaptations of things that were in the public domain.
So in what context was television described as a vast wasteland?
That was Newton Minow, who gave a speech before...
He was the head of the FCC.
This was before, I believe, the National Association of Broadcasters, and he was talking to station owners. And he was very specifically telling him that if you sat in front of your own station, didn't change any channel, just watched your station from sunup to sundown, and this is before it was 24 hours a day, he said, you would see occasional good programs. And he mentioned The Twilight Zone and Bonanza and Meet the Press. But he said, but for the most part, you would find yourself in a vast wasteland. He was being sort of specific and absolutely correct in his criticism. That's a great question.
But wouldn't that be just as true today?
Oh, yeah. No,
in fact, today you have so many more channels to choose from. Wasn't there a song once, 300 channels
and nothing 57 channels and nothing on, I think, was the name of that one.
We've all had that experience of flipping through the guide.
Right. Well, Theodore Sturgeon once said that 90% of everything is crap, and he didn't say crap. Mm-hmm. But
thank you for not saying a word that the FCC won't allow.
Right. But with television, what's happened certainly in this century is that while the quantity has exploded exponentially, the quality has gotten better also. And I think it now rivals other popular art forms in terms of what's the most popular and the best.
Is there any particular event or show that marked the beginning of what you are calling the platinum age of TV?
I think so, but I had to figure it out. I argued with myself, and I had different starting points. But I ended up with 1999, with The West Wing on NBC, the last of one of the great network dramas, and then HBO's The Sopranos, one of the first of the great cable dramas.
Neither of which are with us anymore.
That's true. And neither is my favorite, one of my favorite programs of all time, Breaking Bad, although its prequel, Better Call Saul, is still here.
And you like that?
Yes.
How did cable TV influence the process?
In a couple of different ways. At first, cable TV just brought unedited movies and rawer language and nudity and violence.
At least the premium channels.
Yes,
did.
The premium channels, exactly. And then the cable channels did a version of that. And so what broadcast TV did to try to compete was to be a little bit more mature, and that's how we got NYPD Blue and everything that came since.
Well, initially, when cable came along, people talked about narrowcasting, that the cable channels would be aimed specifically at a certain group, and they didn't have to get big audiences. That lasted about 10 minutes.
I know. And it's the same sort of thing as when, you may remember when FM radio first came in, and we were going to have opera channels, and we were going to have jazz channels, and yet the owners of these stations increasingly wanted to go for the biggest slices of the pie, so everybody went to compete, you know, with the same AM rock or whatever they were going for. Same things happened with cable TV.
Many millennials don't watch on a TV set and don't have cable subscriptions. Is that having an impact?
Yes. The impact that they like, the people who are making television, is that they can reach these people at various times and at various places. As a television critic and historian, what disturbs me about it is that the communal shared experience of television we are losing, and losing rapidly, and I think we'll lose an appreciation of TV history with it.
Because pretty much all of what you're writing about here somehow is either for or made by the boomers.
Mm-hmm. And, well, even the most recent stuff, because there are programs that are targeted more towards the millennials, but the thing that is the biggest misconception, I think, about TV today is that today's young TV audience is more exposed to television past and present than it ever was, because it's all available streaming or on DVD. But the truth is, they're not watching that much, and they're certainly, they don't have the appetite, unless they're prodded, to go back and watch the old stuff. Just because it's available doesn't mean it's being sampled.
A lot was made of the huge audiences you'd have for a show like the last episode of MASH. Mm-hmm. Today you can't get an audience like that. Maybe for the Super Bowl? Or
Not even.
The debates?
Well, the debates, but what they're doing there is they're doing an aggregate of every single network and broadcasting cable that put them together. Got them past the 100 million mark.
But MASH was on one channel.
Right. And has a record that I think, in terms of scripted programming, will never be beaten.
My guest is David Bianculli. His book, The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific, is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How does somebody become a TV critic?
I think there are various ways. There used to be various ways of doing it. The toughest part is you have to get in print. Now you can do it just by starting your own blog, and if somebody notices you, you go up from there. But I actually went to college wanting to be a TV critic before there were media courses in how to be one. So I would take a course in statistics to understand ratings. I would take media law to understand that, and then take every film course and other course that I could, just to try to get a general sense.
And how do you see your function as a critic? Because different critics work differently and approach their jobs differently.
It's a great question. I define my own function as the thing that I love to do the most as a TV critic is to steer people towards stuff that I love that they may not see otherwise. And so it's sort of like I'm a prospector that's constantly panning for little nuggets and then trying to share them.
One of the people you interviewed for this book was Louis C.K., and he remembered a particularly bad review you wrote about one of his shows.
Yeah, that's true.
What was it that you didn't like?
Well, it was his first show for HBO called Lucky Louie, and it was a fascinating idea, which was to sort of take the honeymooners' sensibility and do it modern day, but do it the same way with, you know, three camera sitcom and that's that whole sort of approach. But I just didn't like the show. But I didn't remember how much I didn't like the show. But when I interviewed Louis C.K. for the first time, he did, and he sort of told me not only how much I hated it, but then he got into this whole discussion about the relationship between a critic and an artist that I learned from and found fascinating.
Because there are, sometimes I've read reviews, not necessarily yours, where the reviewer seems to be saying, get out of this business, you're never going to make it. And I think that that is really not the role of a critic.
Yeah, no, I don't think, you know, even when I do not like something, I try to be positive and or to at least be constructive in terms of the criticism. But this program of Louis was one that I did not do that. and to have him come back at it. And when I said, well, I hope you appreciate how much I love your FX series, Louis, and he goes, no, you're missing my point. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that we were both in the arena, both caring about it passionately. That's what matters.
Have you been successful in steering people to appreciate certain programs?
It depends. I have a website, TV Worth Watching, where the readership there is very appreciative. But when I wrote for the Daily News, you know only when you hear from people. So I don't know how much it is in terms of measurement. But
well, when Cheers first was broadcast and it was not doing well, didn't you try to save it?
Yeah, I was a younger person then. I did. I was at the Akron Beacon Journal.
I don't know if you're the one who saved it, but it did rather well.
No, I know I'm not the one who saved it, but I had this idea. Cheers was such a great show, and it was right after it had gotten to be the lowest rated show on television that week. And this is because of the Nielsen ratings, which at the time were done with these boxes in 1,700 homes, and every major city had a certain number of boxes, and they were called Nielsen families. So I wrote a column inviting any Nielsen family within range of the Akron Beacon Journal to come to my house on Thursday night, and I would let them watch whatever they wanted to on my TV. I would serve them dinner. I would serve them drinks. All they had to do was turn their TVs, which were rated, to NBC before they left. Mm. And turns out that's against the law, sort of.
Well, I suspect you also praised certain shows to the skies in hopes of getting people to watch, and it didn't work.
Oh, absolutely.
Any that you think were you're really sad about?
Well, my favorite scripted television program of all time is still something that I'm confident most people have never seen and many people haven't heard of, which is a 1986 British miniseries by Dennis Potter called The Singing Detective. Mm-hmm. And it was never shown nationally in the United States. And
believe it or not, this show is old enough so that we did a segment on The Singing Detective way back when.
Bless you. And that you had the taste to do that back then is magnificent.
But it was on Channel 13 here.
It was on Channel 13 here, but it was on at 11 o'clock at night, stretched over three nights, so it wasn't in prime time. And public TV stations had the decision to run it individually, not as PBS, because Dennis Potter had a contract that would not allow any editing, and it was a very rough mm-hmm. miniseries.
We love Dennis Potter. That's who we had on our show. You've organized the book by genre. How many genres did you find, and how many did you look at?
For the purposes of the book, I narrowed it down to, I think, 15. And there are plenty more. I listed another 10 in the conclusion that I could have done. But, you know, books have to stop.
15 because you split the sitcom into three genres.
Yeah, well, there's when you think about the sitcom, there's the family sitcom, like Leave It to Beaver, and there's the workplace sitcom, like Cheers, where it almost all takes place at a workplace. And then there's a hybrid of the two, like the Andy Griffith Show, where sometime you're at work and sometimes you're at home, and there are clearly defined universes in each. And that I called a splitcom. I don't know if that's going to catch on or not.
And then there were variety shows, some of which were outgrowths of vaudeville and some that had a very different feeling.
Yeah, and some are sketch-heavy and some are music-heavy or performance-heavy. It all, if you think of these things in Darwinian terms, they're not clearly divided by phylum and class. They slip all over one another.
I'm speaking with David Benkuli, who is a guest host and TV critic on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. He has been a contributor to that show since its inception. He's been a TV critic since 1975. His latest book is The Platinum Age of Television, from I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. It is published by Doubleday. When we come back, we'll look at some of those genres, but right now we're just going to go to a little break. And We're back with David Bianculli. His book, The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific, is published by Doubleday. And we were talking about genres. Let's talk a bit about kids' shows, because that's the way most of us actually begin watching television. Mm-hmm. Were most of the original kids' shows local?
They started off as local.
Howdy Doody?
And live, yes.
My favorite, Kuk, LaFran, and Ollie?
Yes. Good for you. Good for you.
Well, we had...
Yeah, Kuk, LaFran, and Ollie started out of Chicago, and Howdy Doody in 1947 was the first one to go network on NBC, back when NBC was just two or three connected cities on the East Coast.
Didn't the Romper Room host look into the camera and address the kids by name?
Yes.
And, as though she was seeing them? That was a different role for TV.
And I fell for that as a kid. I'm old enough to have remembered sitting there waiting for her to call out my name and just, you know, jumping up and down like, see me, see me. But
when did Mr. Rogers get his own show?
He started in Pittsburgh as a program called Children's Corner with Josie Carey. But he was the puppeteer and wrote the music. And since... that program started in Pittsburgh about the same time I started in Pittsburgh, I was able to see that local show as one of the first TV programs I ever saw.
Was he a psychologist?
No, he was studying in terms of the seminary. He was so caught up in doing things for children, and he was an actual ordained minister. And but he had a passion for dealing with children that never wavered.
Does anyone deal with the difficult issues the way he did today?
I don't think so. I would love to be able to point to a modern counterpart, but I don't think there's anyone even close. And
he talked about things like the assassination of Robert Kennedy and then about John Lennon and the attempt on Reagan's life.
Yeah, he actually went to public TV a few months after his show started and asked for an hour of evening, you know, prime time to talk to parents and their children about what had happened the day before when Bobby Kennedy was shot, and to do it in a way that was indirect and yet very direct in dealing with what kids may have been going through at the time.
I remember when there was talk in Congress of cutting back funding for public television, and then the outcry was, but you'd be getting rid of Sesame Street.
Yeah.
Sesame Street pretty much changed kids' TV.
Yes, and actually Fred Rogers showed up in front of that hearing, in front of Joe Pastore.
Even though he had nothing to gain.
Well, he had something to gain, because if the funding were cut from public television, he would lose his platform. But he defended it by talking about what he did for children, and it was, I think, $20 million was at stake then. And at the end of Fred Rogers speaking, Senator Pastore said, I think he just earned the $20 million.
How did Saturday morning become cartoon time?
It got more and more lucrative because, first of all, in the late 50s, early 60s, there was usually only one television in the home. And so it was controlled almost all the time by the parents. But Saturday morning, if parents were sleeping in or otherwise occupied, it was the one time when kids could control the dial. And so advertisers and broadcasters all started aiming for children.
And it changed the way the movie theaters worked, because when I was a kid, I would go see a double feature and there would always be cartoons in between. None of those... they all disappeared from the movie theaters.
Yeah, cartoons with programs like the Mickey Mouse Club and Saturday Morning, when they would take old cartoons from Dave Fleischer and you know, other things like Mighty Mouse, Mickey Mouse, all of them would show up on Saturday Morning in programs of their own.
And then we started seeing cartoons on primetime, aimed at adults.
Yeah, and that was one of the things in doing the research for this book. One of the really weird facts that I came up with is in the entire history of television, only one animated program has ever ended a season in the top 20. And it's not the one I thought it would have been. It's not The Simpsons.
Really?
It's not Family Guy. It's not South Park. it's the Flintstones. That's weird to
me. I don't know what that says about America. But
I know. I know. But it said it way back then.
I am very proud of the fact that 30 years ago, Matt Groening was a guest on our show with a couple of other cartoonists. He had just published a book. And I said, I asked, so what's next? Some more books? He said, no, you know that cartoon series that I've done for the Tracy Ullman show? Well, Fox has decided to give us a weekly show. And I said, well, good luck with it.
Yes. So you had him on for the Life in Hell books,
yes.
Right? Yeah, well, he's a wonderful guy. And he was somebody else that I got to interview for. That was a fun thing about the book, was talking to people whose work on TV I've loved so much and not steer them specifically in any directions. I didn't say, what did you think of The Twilight Zone or I Love Lucy? I said, well, what did you watch as a kid?
So are most of the cartoon shows these days aimed at adults?
More than not, yes. That's a good observation.
Now, we also, let's talk a bit about the variety sketch shows. They range from Ed Sullivan on the one hand to the Smothers Brothers on the other. We don't see them these days, although I guess the late night shows to some degree fill that gap.
They're doing some of it. Jimmy Fallon is doing some variety show kind of stuff. And if you think about it being it evolving, what James Corden is doing with Carpool Karaoke is very much in the style of old variety. But the most recent official version, which was Maya and Marty on NBC, Maya Rudolph and Martin Short, it wasn't good enough. But I still keep thinking with the right host and the right format and the right writers, it could work.
Well, when I think of the impact that Ed Sullivan had on the one hand.
No, huge.
Elvis and the Beatles and whatever. Yes. And then the Smothers Brothers, they broke the blacklist when they put Pete Seeger on. They brought politics into variety shows. They had Pat Paulson running for president.
They did a brilliant thing with Pat Paulson for president. I cared so much about the Smothers Brothers that I wrote a whole separate book about them. And they, in prime time on a broadcast TV network, were doing the sorts of commentary about politics, about drugs and sex and everything in terms of anti-war that today the followers would be people like Bill Maher and John Oliver, Colbert, but they're all doing it in late night and most of them on cable. The Smothers Brothers were doing it smack dab in the middle of broadcast TV.
You say I Love Lucy was a game changer. Now, I would associate Lucy with the old television, not the new television.
It was old, but it was such a game changer that it gets to count. The year was 1951, and mostly because Desi Arnaz wanted to send good copies of what he was doing with his new show with his wife back to his relatives in Cuba, that he went to something that was being used on a quiz show, which was three or four camera setup, and you shot it and edited it live. And instead of being a kinescope that you filmed with one camera on a TV monitor and it gave you this muddy image and sound, it was crisp. That's why if you watch I Love Lucy today, it still looks great. It looks filmed. And it changed everything. It changed East Coast to West Coast. It changed live to tape.
But then other things also changed things. All in the Family, for example, brought serious politics into sitcoms. You had The Cosby Show, unfortunately tarnished now by other things, mm-hmm. outside things, but it changed attitudes about race in this country. Will and Grace and Modern Family addressed accepting gay people.
Yep.
So these shows all had real impact on American society.
And those are all, again, if you treat it like a biology course, those are all evolutions. Those are all key markers in the development of TV. I mean, a situation comedy, there are times where you can have on the Andy Griffith Show or on Louie, whole minutes, entire minutes go by without a single punchline or a joke, but they're still considered sitcoms.
But these days, a show like The Big Bang Theory, which is very funny,
mm-hmm.
it's been my sense that somebody says, "Hi, I'm Mary," and you hear the laughter.
Yeah, no, it's very standard.
Every gets a laugh.
And old school, but it's also one of the most popular comedies on television today. So the formulas still can work and can be accepted if they're well acted.
For workplace sitcoms, The Larry Sanders Show is a personal favorite of mine,
yeah,
partly
mine too,
because it got things right.
Yeah, and that was such an interesting thing because it showed two different worlds. It got the world of TV right in terms of the talk show as a talk show, and then it got the world right behind the scenes of the making of a talk show. And those were two entirely different avenues to have to explore, and they got the tones of both of them just right.
And then we have the single woman sitcom, Mary Tyler Moore Show, Days and Nights of Molly Dodd.
Yeah, that's almost like a missing link. Most people don't even remember that show, but that was Blair Brown as a single working woman in New York, and she is definitely a link between Mary Tyler Moore and...
Well, there's Marlo Thomas in the middle.
Yes, in That Girl. No, Marlo Thomas is even before, you know, and then you have, later on, you have Sex and the City, and you have Girls. It's a fascinating continuum, at least to me.
You say that the Andy Griffith Show spun off from the Danny Thomas Show.
Yes.
I never thought of that.
It's really something, and that was a showbiz decision. Sheldon Leonard, who was one of the producers, was responsible for I Spy, responsible in part for the Dick Van Dyke Show. He had his name, and his fingerprints all over some of the most significant TV of the 60s. And the Danny Thomas Show... they just did a backdoor pilot where they took one episode and had Danny drive through a small town, which happened to be Mayberry, and be stopped by a small town sheriff who just happened to be played by Andy Griffith. And if that worked, then they would spin off a sitcom, and it did.
There have been detective shows and cop shows throughout the history of television, but it's my sense that Hill Street Blues was a lot more daring than anything we even see today.
Yeah, that borrowed as much from movies and documentaries as it did from any existing cop
show. Why didn't that evolve into even better television? Today they all seem so formulaic. We get involved with their personal lives, and then a subplot seems to be that there was somebody who was murdered, and you barely pay much attention to it. At the end, somebody has an epiphany, and they go and they arrest the person.
Right. Well, you know, Hill Street was one of the first dramas to structure with an A story, a B story, a C story, like soap operas had done for many years, and to put it into a crime genre, and then also to visually do it more like Robin Altman did his films, and making the sound and the images more like real life, like handheld chaos.
Well, we do have The Wire, but The Wire was cable again.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the best shows started up going to cable because of freedom, and that's a trend that is continuing. The broadcast networks don't know why they're losing audience, and they're losing audience because they're not taking risks. They're trying to go for tried and true, and there's less of that works.
Seasons are shorter. It used to be that the season would last three quarters of a year,
yes,
and then half a year, and now it's often one quarter of the year.
Yeah, people my age, the elders, will remember when TV Guide came out with its fall preview, and you waited for that and studied it to make your decisions about what to watch for the next 9 months, because things were pretty stagnant. You know, if a show was bad, it would last only one season, and then it would be replaced the next fall. And then you had to decide, do I watch Bonanza, or do I watch The Smothers Brothers, this new program that's on at the same time? And that's what you decided. You couldn't time shift. You couldn't get it later on DVD.
Or on demand now.
Right, or on demand. You made your choices then.
So I assume
that
also...
That sounds so crank. And then you had to walk in the snow to see it. I'm sorry.
But also, it seems to me that the actors don't want to get tied down to 30 whatever it is weeks.
Right. Well, that's led to a renaissance in the miniseries and in limited series, which is a fascinating, exciting thing that's happened in just the past couple of years, where an actor like Matthew McConaughey, who wouldn't sign up for a 7-year TV series, will show up for X number of episodes of True Detective on HBO. And you get Fargo that way. You get American Horror Story. You get American Crime Story.
My favorite, The Americans.
Yes, The Americans. Well, The Americans, that's a regular weekly series that goes on. But again, that's what, 10 episodes, I think?
It's a very brief season.
Per season, yes.
David Bianculli's fourth book, the one we've been discussing, is The Platinum Age of Television, from I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. It's published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks. It was really a pleasure.